Welcome to Positively Psychic. Positively Psychic. 2 hours of fascinating interviews and call-ins with your host, the Positively Psychic medium, Mark Christopher Nelson. Positively Psychic. During the show, Mark will invite you to call in to speak with him and his guests. Call in for a free reading and contact your guides, guardian angels, friends, and loved ones on the other side. Positively Psychic. Join the online chat to share thoughts and experiences with like-minded souls at www.para-x.com. Positively Psychic. Listen in now as the Positively Psychic medium, Mark Christopher Nelson, interviews leading experts in the paranormal field, takes your calls, and answers your questions on Positively Psychic.
Hello, welcome to Positively Psychic. I'm your psychic medium host, Mark Christopher Nelson, and I'm here with my psychic spouse.
Hello, everyone.
That would be Barbara Nelson. Barbara Ann Nelson. We never say your middle name. We're going to say your middle name.
Just say psychic spouse.
Psychic spouse, Barbara. She'll work with both. Well, tonight, we have a real treat for you. We have a guest who's another one of these wonderful friends of ours from England who's decided to stay up to the wee hours of their time to tell us about a fascinating film. Now, all of you have heard about Dan Brown with his Da Vinci Code. We've all heard about the possibility that the Holy Grail, and however you might perceive that, might have been kept at certain times or found a home at Roslyn Chapel, a place of mystery. Well, our guest tonight is suggesting that it could be a very different chapel. It could be a very different church. And Barb and I watched the film last night, and our heads were spinning because it's as if we were brought back in time by a master sleuth who is basically taking us to the scene of a murder. And it's a murder that the Catholic Church would probably deny. And that countless people throughout history would. The name of the film is The Murder of Mary Magdalene, Genocide of the Holy Bloodline. And tonight's guest is Dan Green, a documentary filmmaker. Welcome, Dan. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Hello, and greetings from the city of Lincoln in England, Mark.
How wonderful.
Lincoln. Well, we were just talking off the air. Lincoln has a place it's near and dear to many Americans because of our President Lincoln. But we were also talking about many of the different unusual connections between Lincolns throughout history.
Yes. It seems that there seems to be a significance attached to the word, actually. And in our country, our county, Lincolnshire, the abbreviation for Lincolnshire, where all this activity is occurring, is simply L-I-N-C-S, links. So I'm not surprised that in an almost strangely, almost comedy and yet deadly serious fashion, we are experiencing more links than one would expect in a certain area. But it does seem to extend wherever the word may be, including your American president, because it's quite well documented the amazing amount of synchronicities that occurred with the assassination of President Lincoln. Amazing stuff in its own right.
Oh, it is. Well, tonight we have the real pleasure of having you on to discuss your film about the actual reality behind the Holy Grail and who that Holy... Is it an item, the Holy Grail, or was it a person? And what do you think?
Well, centuries ago, the perceived wisdom was that it was people were seeking some chalice, which was related to Jesus Christ at the Last Supper. But in more recent times, and thanks to efforts such as you mentioned, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code and the book before that Dan borrowed so much from, the Holy Blood, the Holy Grail, that it just seems to be a symbolic reference to a bloodline associated with the biblical figure of Mary Magdalene. It's no longer a chalice. It's if anything, a female gynecology, but certainly to do with pregnancy and, in our storyline, Mary Magdalene.
Well, in the film, you make a very convincing case for the fact that Mary Magdalene, her death is actually connected to Lincoln Chapel. and or Lincoln Cathedral, I'm sorry. And it's a magnificent, beautiful place. But throughout history, a lot of people have questioned whether this is a place of great evil, whether it's a place of holiness. I mean, it's an there's so much mystery wrapped around this place. And then when, just so everyone knows, when you watch this film, Dan, step by step, makes a compelling argument that if we were in a court of law, it would be very, very difficult to dismiss the suggestions and the inferences and the claims that you're making.
Well, that's right, Mark. We depend a lot on psychology, just in the same way that forensics use psychological departments when they try to solve a murder too. So it's quite scientific in many areas too.
Well, as you start out, I mean, there are so many things that if you were not looking at the big picture, you might just say, oh, that's a random statue.
This is exactly what happened, Mark. And when you gather them all in, it's like a join the dots puzzle, if you know what that represents. And then you see the total picture through a refreshed pair of eyes. I quite often point out that the neurological condition of scotoma, which means that when somebody looks at something, a painting or a portrait or a photograph even, the brain tends to just see what it's expecting to see, therefore misses a lot of hidden symbology in there. But once we wise up to that, we suddenly can see through a refreshed pair of eyes. I mean, the brain is so easy to be tricked, as we all know. Just basic optical illusions can trick the brain. Even though we know it's an optical illusion, the brain will still see the illusion. So once we become aware of how it prefers to just see what we expect to see, we have to concede that there's lots of things that we will miss until they are pointed out. Then we do see them. A classic example there is Da Vinci's Last Supper, where nobody seemed to notice for a long, long time until it was pointed out that the figure immediately next to the Christ had always been thought to be John the Disciple. But when you take a close look at it, it's clearly a feminine figure. Lots of people now accept that it does portray Mary Magdalene. And of course, lots of people never noticed that just a little bit further from the Mary figure is a disembodied hand wielding a knife. Now, we can all see that now. We know it's there. We can see it without a problem. But for centuries, nobody noticed it simply because they weren't looking for it.
It's very true. In the film, you bring together names that we've heard before from the past, but you create and draw connections to them that are really quite startling and breathtaking. You have the Knights Templar. You have the Priory of Sion, if I'm saying the name, I'm not sure correctly.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And that some of the hidden symbols behind them before, I mean, we've heard these names, but can you explain to people why people such as those belonging to the Knights Templar and the Priory of Sion would have to hide their messages in such layered ciphers? Why didn't they just go to the newspaper and say, I have a story? The story is this, that the Catholic Church came in, and we believe that there's very good evidence that they may have killed someone who, in fact, was related to Jesus Christ. Why couldn't they do that in that time?
Well, long, long ago, the Church was the only authority, and they handed out the official storyline. People weren't really free thinkers in those days. To learn anything, you had to go and approach the Church. So they were like the very first instigators of the original storyline, which we look back upon as free thinkers and realize it was something that they were feathering their own nest, really, by promoting themselves as the one and only authority that God Almighty would use as a channel, and to contradict anything that they may have written or thought or presented would have came under the title of heresy, which quite often people ended up on a pyre and were burned. You know, I mean, historically
yes.
Speaking, when we go back to Béziers in France in 1209, there was an absolute massacre of 20,000 people. The village of Béziers was stormed on the 22nd of July, which is the feast of Mary Magdalene. because the Catholic Church weren't happy that this mystery had been passed on as a secret. Too many people knew about it. A particular Christian cult called the Cathars, they perpetuate the mystery and therefore had to be removed because they were so great in numbers. And on that particular day alone, in 1209, their village was stormed and 20,000 people were exterminated simply because it was known that they had a truth that contradicted this biblical storyline that we'd been, I have to say, force-fed for centuries, really, and couldn't really contradict. Otherwise, it would be a very fearful situation we'd find ourselves in. And this persecution of the Cathars alone carried on. And in 1244, at a place called Montségur, again in France, that was like the final massacre. And with that, it was perceived that this alternative storyline would have been snuffed out once and for all, really. But it's never, ever gone away. Never, ever gone away. Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, which we now know, as Dan said, is a mixture of fact and fiction, kept it alive in recent years. Prior to that, the million-selling book, The Holy Blood, The Grail, did exactly the same. And before that, even, it had always been kind of traditionally passed on, an alternative storyline dating back to the biblical Jesus and Mary.
Well, I have to tell you, the pictures that you brought us, it's one thing to read about them in a book, but what you've done very, very effectively in your documentary is that you've walked us through the church. You've pointed to the symbols. You've explained the symbols. And once you, Barbara and I were sitting and watching your film, and we're thinking, gosh, you just, you know, opened up a very big piece of information to us, and then you opened up another one and another one. It was like, my head's gonna explode any moment. But the truth of it is that the facts were compelling. It was interesting, and some of the things that it must have taken so much work to come across some of the understanding, some of the facts behind these what would appear to be random symbols. Can you give people an idea of, first off, where your idea for this film started?
Right, we'll start at the start the best I can. Again, going back to the million best-selling book which came out in 1982, The Holy Blood, The Holy Grail, which was written by three British authors, highlighted the global mystery of Rennes-le-Château, which is a small village in France. Now, in the 1890s, a parish priest who took over Rennes-le-Château, a fellow called Berengier Saunier, suddenly stumbled across some sort of secret almost overnight that made him ridiculously wealthy and in the position we now assume he could have been blackmailing the Vatican over whatever secret he discovered. Now, it seems to be the same secret that the Knights Templar discovered even earlier, sometimes between the years 1110 and 1120 in Sion, Jerusalem. And they went on to become an exceedingly wealthy order also. And the secret, we now realize, certainly had something to do with Mary Magdalene. Now, the first thing that this Saunier priest did was renovate his church, which was a church dedicated to Mary. And he put a lot of bizarre symbology, certainly quite anti-Christian, really, in his church. Now, this went on to become the global mystery of Rennes-le-Château in the early 80s. It was the mystery at the time, more so than UFOs, pyramids, whatever. Yeah. Rennes-le-Château was the mystery. Now, I went there in 1986 to have some research there myself. Now, Rennes-le-Château was high up a hill. At the top of the hill is a church dedicated to Mary Magdalene. And when you go in the church, you are greeted by a very strange figure. It's a demonic statue. Now,
yes, it looks like a monkey or something, isn't that it?
Well, it's supposed to be the demon Asmodeus. People are forever trying. It was guardian of treasure, actually, in Jewish mythologies. So back in Lincoln, I noticed that Lincoln Cathedral, the great Gothic Cathedral of Lincoln, which was built in 1097, it's also high up a hill. there was a Mary Magdalene church there. It was one of the earliest in the British Isles, and that was demolished to make way for the building of Lincoln Cathedral. That you of a demon. So I noticed the parallels between Renlyn Chateau and Lincoln, because Sonia had found two parchments, which may have been the very reason why he stumbled across this secret and treasure. And to this day, nobody had really successfully decoded these parchments. So I'm thinking about Lincoln Cathedral may have had some importance. This was over 20 years ago, because Sonia left his clues in his church in France, so it was quite natural for people to assume that if you could decode the clues, any liable treasure or whatever he's trying to lead us to would be in the area of Renlyn Chateau of France. But not so, because my lengthy research has brought it from France over to Lincoln, where as part of my research I managed to decode Sonia's parchments in a fashion that most people can follow.
Yeah, I have to jump in. That document that we saw, it looked like basically almost a grid. It was a very complicated cipher, as far as I could tell. And it looked like that. I mean, was it in Latin, these words, or what was it?
Yes, it was. It was broken by. It was translated, if you like, by cipher code experts. I think they were associated with British intelligence, actually. And this was put in the Holy Blood, Holy Grail book of 1982. And the translation, if you like, was therefore made widespread to everybody. But the final printout was as cryptic as anything. And people would just look at it and try and see what they could do with it, but nobody successfully explained it once it had been translated from the original and deliberate and contrived Latin. But lo and behold, it decodes in Lincoln Cathedral, as you say, with architecture and strategically placed items.
Well, what we saw, if you watch the film, and again, I want to give everybody a chance to look for the film. It's The Murder of Mary Magdalene by Reality Films. It's The Murder of Mary Magdalene, Genocide of the Holy Bloodline. And what if there's a website, where could people find the information if they wanted to purchase the film?
I think the quickest route for that one, Mark, is simply to go to YouTube, where they can discover a trailer, the official trailer for the movie. So if they go to YouTube and simply type in The Murder of Mary Magdalene, they'll get a link there that will take them to Reality, where they can actually get the product if they so wish.
Well, one of the things that I saw, Dan, is that it seemed like there's a huge, beautiful, ornate stained glass window with many small pieces of glass depicting different
yes.
images. And that seems to be a very critical part of explaining everything else that you're looking at.
Absolutely. Well, as I say, I've been at Renlyn Chateau, and I've noticed the parallels between the church there and the great Gothic Cathedral of Lincoln. And then in 2005, something quite amazing happened. A glazier was high up his ladders at the great east window, at the scene of the Last Supper. He was doing some restoration, cleaning the glass. Now, at the scene of the Last Supper, which is very Da Vinci, if we think about that, on Christ's platter, there should be a cup or a loaf of bread. But on the stained glass window at Lincoln Cathedral, we see neither. What we find instead is a dog. How strange.
Yeah,
a dog on the plate.
And what is the symbolism? Of course, it makes you wonder, why a dog? I mean, it has nothing to do with, like, God spelled backwards.
No, obviously people do notice that. Well, Masonic lodges, Freemasons and Masonic lodges, have a symbol in all their lodges. It's their main symbol, and it's a five-point star, and it's referred to as the Blazing Star, and it's supposed to be the Blazing Star of the Dog Star Sirius, and that's where it comes in. We've now discovered the Masonic connection within the cathedral, and we have to remember that when the Knights Templar, who carried the secret, when they were set up, as they certainly were, and disbanded, And lots of people thought, again, well, that's that. The secret will be lost forever now because it's gone underground. Masonry came out of Knights Templar. It's almost, if you like, a modern-day masonry. So wherever these clues remain hidden or lost, it's a fair secret that at some point Freemasonry had that under their supervision. So from the Knights Templars, it transmogrified, if you like, into the Freemasons. And that's why in the cathedral we see not once, not twice, but three times this dog figure reappears, hinting that this is something to do Masonic, and therefore is concealing a secret.
Now, Dan, I noticed in the movie there was a part that said they had to actually close down the cathedral because they thought there was a battle between good and evil going on
well,
in there.
Baba, in 1995, the dean of the cathedral at the time made a very startling public announcement to the British press, and he said that he thought that Lincoln Cathedral was a battlefield between good and evil, and that he wanted the cathedral closed for 3 months to have it exorcised with prayer. Now, that's an amazing thing to suddenly hit the British public with, that you're dean of a cathedral and you suddenly announce that you think it's a focus, a battlefield between good and evil. And my take on that is that maybe this has something to do with the fact that Lincoln Cathedral for centuries has been tied up in some sort of secret concerning an alternative storyline of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and what we call the Holy Grail.
Now, this is 1995, not 1695, correct?
No, 1995, and quite recent times. And that dean to this day, and I've approached him best I can, refuses now to talk about that.
So he never really gave a reason why he thought that this...
Well, at the time, he was caught up in a sex scandal, which he walked away from. He was proved to be innocent, but apparently there's a lot of bad vibes that throughout the centuries have... it's like a swirling mass of bad vibes that people from time to time have mentioned seem to be within the cathedral. It's got an interesting history. In 1185 there was an earthquake which almost destroyed it. In 1141 there was a fire that almost destroyed it. It's got quite an interesting history.
And this is a cathedral. You hardly ever think of England or Lincolnshire as a place where devastating earthquakes can come and
well, that's quite right. In Lincolnshire, I mean, looking at here we are today in 2010, it would be unthinkable that we could have anything of that on such a scale in this day and age. But in 1185, there was an earthquake that actually cleaved the cathedral in half. It had to be rebuilt.
My God.
And it's not an area known for it.
Wow. You know, there's one of the things, too, that you brought up. I'd like to go back and have you explain many of the different things that link, that become this tapestry of clues and facts and details. But one of the other things that came up are some of the statues that you would refer to, say, Victor Hugo's statue. Wasn't there a statue, too, for the father of physics?
Isaac Newton. Yeah.
Isaac Newton. I mean.
Well, that's right. I'd decoded the Venla Shadow parchments, and whilst I was doing this, the synchronicity started to kick in. Mark, could you believe this? That whilst I'm discovering a genuine cathedral code in the Gothic Cathedral of Lincoln, who should turn up at Lincoln Cathedral wanting to film actual scenes for Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, but Hollywood turned up on our doorstep?
That's an interesting coincidence.
that's amazing. I mean, I've learned in quantum physics now reinforce what I'm about to say, that there's no such thing as a meaningless coincidence. I mean, coincidences in their own right are an amazing mystery that I doubt we'll ever fathom. Synchronicity is amazing. I mean, too many people like to dismiss very interesting things away simply by saying it's a coincidence. But what is a coincidence? It's something that's been brought to the table. And at the same time, I couldn't help but notice another amazing synchronicity, that of the three authors who wrote The Holy Blood and The Holy Grail in 1982, which reopened all this once again, the main author in that one, who headed off to France looking for the clues in France, has the surname Lincoln. It's Henry Lincoln. He actually set the ball rolling, this Holy Blood, Holy Grail stuff in Britain. He set the ball rolling, and his surname is Lincoln too. So he'd gone over in France looking for clues, and he wears the surname Lincoln, where they all seem to come back to, and another amazing synchronicity.
Well, I often say, well, it's just a coincidence, and then the people I'm with, we all tend to laugh together. Ha, yeah, a coincidence.
That's what happened, yeah, and people just dismiss it. But like I say, research into quantum physics now are looking at things like what exactly are coincidences, and that there are no meaningless ones. They all have meanings when events synchronize. It's like you take a look at a spider's web. If you think about it, there's no point on that web that isn't joined up somewhere. It could be at a great distance from one point, but the geometry of that web is all interconnected, is it not? It's an amazing piece of geometry. So any given point, if you just follow along here and down, much about, and I think synchronicity, coincidence, is one of those things.
Well, I have to tell you, I work as a psychic medium. I feel like that these things that we call synchronicity is spirit, is God's way of kind of grabbing us by the chin and turning our heads to look at something.
I totally agree with that, Mark. Yes.
And if you, totally. How can you not acknowledge the fact that these unusual things, they are meant to make us think? I mean, the universe, God, doesn't have the luxury of going to our email and sending us a message. And the idea of sending a message to one person, unless it's like a very personal connection through a psychic, isn't good. But I love, like, you have that one example of the newspaper. On the front side, again, this is something that Dan brings up in the film. It starts out talking about how Dan, the newspaper says, well, Dan Brown may have, X marks the spot where Dan Green, pardon me, has located a treasure. And then on the back it says, Moses leads the way. I mean, if that's...
These things happen all the time, Mark. It's really interesting. Researchers have pointed out for decades now that when you start noticing synchronicities, they just seem to pop up faster and faster. They're there all the time, always around us. But like I said earlier about Scott Omer, we just don't notice them. But once you realize the phenomenon of synchronicity and coincidence, then they pop up everywhere. But the secret is they've always been there. It's just we have to perhaps raise our consciousness to be aware of exactly the full 360 degrees of what is out there all the time. We seem to live our lives wearing a pair of blinkers on, and we don't see the full picture.
Well, one of the things that I would say, while we're talking about ciphers and codes and all of that, some of the imagery in and around the church is very, very blatant. If you open your eyes just a little bit, statues looking at certain places, they're looking at markers that have names and words and descriptions. And then it's as much, I mean, why watch the movie The Da Vinci Code when you can walk around this church? I mean, I would recommend people watch your film, take it with them. I don't know if you have a companion to go with it to help people explain and understand what it is that they're seeing as they walk around.
I've done this a few times, actually, Mark, when I found out that people have came over to Lincoln Cathedral specifically because of my work. Because I live very nearby, I felt obliged to meet up with them and take them around and explain things. It takes on average about 3 hours, actually. It's amazing. You think, oh, this will take about half an hour, but to do it thoroughly takes about 3 hours. And it's a great experience for me also because, like I say, just because I've brought all this to everybody's attention doesn't mean to say that I'm excluded from being amazed by it also. It's almost as if, you know, I didn't go out looking for this mystery. It came and found me.
Well, I would think, too, that once you've put a point, connected this dot to this dot to this dot, my inclination would be to turn around and find as many people as I can and say, hey, look at this. This is amazing. And in a sense, you're doing that with the film.
Well, right. I mean, I wrote all this up in two small books, and as you say, it leads to a very definite X marks the spot, which could be the solution overall to the Ren Le Chateau mystery. And now, I could have left it at that. Really, like you say, the evidence is very compelling, very persuasive. I've just presented it as I found it and shared it with everybody. Now, I could have left it at X marks the spot, but I thought, well, what else is there left for me to do? So I thought, well, let's turn to science here. We can have a ground-penetrating radar scan, which, as you know, can detect any objects at depth. Very scientific, so you can't argue with that sort of science. So I went to the chief executive of Lincoln Cathedral, because obviously my work has received a lot of attention nationally. And I said, well, look, I've got such a precise location here. How about we have a GPR scan, which will confirm or not exactly what I'm saying. Now, I was quite prepared to pay for this myself. I'd got the assistance of the top country, the top company in the country, who are very well established in this sort of thing. And the executive said, well, it's not going to be any structural damage. The scan's pretty straightforward. I don't see that there'd be a problem with this. So that was fine. I announced it to the public. The cathedral themselves announced it to the public. And then as I got nearer the date for the scan, the cathedral did an amazing U-turn and went rather silent on me, but wouldn't allow me to have the scan. Now, why?
Well, I would say that their silence was deafening, if ever there was. I mean, it clearly had to be that someone knew that there was a secret, there was something there that, you know, even that the off chance that this information might be true. I mean, they couldn't risk having you come up with anything that might... I mean, we're not talking about a small doctoral change. What you're discovering, or what you would find, even in a small way, could cause amazing ripples through not only Christianity, but through Western culture.
That's right. That's the way most people perceive it, Mark, that having gone away and thought about it, they didn't want to be responsible for involving themselves in something that could really have been such a big embarrassment to them, really. So I guess having thought about it, they decided not to go ahead.
Well, there's no win-win. I mean, there's win-win for you because you get the world to recognize that this is too compelling to ignore. If they find anything, there is nothing good that can come from it. If, say, you're the Catholic Church, you're the Church of England, you're any Christian organization.
Well, you know, Mark, I actually approached, not directly, but through his office, I approached the Archbishop of Canterbury, who's the head of the Christian Church in England and the British Isles, to see if he could overthrow their decision. And his office was quite sympathetic, but they educated me in telling me that even the Archbishop of Canterbury cannot overturn a decision that's made by an individual cathedral. But I did actually approach him over that.
Well, that must have... Again, what a fascinating conversation that must have been to be discovering the limits of the Archbishop of Canterbury over religious... A blockbuster historic and religious find there in the British Isles.
That's right. I had no idea that him being the head of the church, I thought he'd be able to overrule any decision, popular or otherwise, but no. The rule book says that if a cathedral makes a decision concerning its old affairs, then nobody else can overturn that. Well, so again, I did everything that I could possibly do.
Well, yeah, and then you did a little more than perhaps you were supposed to.
Yes, nicely put. Nicely put.
Well, that was a fun trip. But before we tell people about some of your, shall we say, extracurricular exploration, can you tell us a little bit about some of the amazing imagery? Because on the outside of the church, you have beautiful, ornate sculptures of a queen looking into a graveyard at a marker. I mean,
well, that's right. Going back there in the Chateau parchments. I'll quickly read the very cryptic one of the parchments. This was translated from the Latin, and of course, nobody at this present day has successfully been able to reveal it. I'll quickly go through it because it's quite short, but it won't make much sense to a listener. Here we go. Shepherdess, no temptation, but Poussard Teniers hold the key piece 681. By the cross and this horse of God, I complete this guardian demon. At midday, blue apples. Now then, is that cryptic or what?
It is, but then you walk into the church, and Dan does an amazing job basically connecting. It's cryptic until you go into that church, and then you say, well, that's a funny place for a dog. That's a funny place. So aren't those blue apples? Can you tell people a little bit about that journey you took?
Yes, the statue you're talking about is on the southeast corner of the Lincoln Cathedral, and it's looking over to burial grounds. It's the burial grounds of St. Margaret, and this is where our quest actually ends. St. Eleanor is the lady that you're talking about on the southeast corner. She's carved there, and she's actually the shepherdess. Nobody had ever noticed that this pregnant, that this statue showed a lady who was clearly pregnant. Nobody ever mentioned that. And she's looking over into the burial grounds of St. Margaret. Now, St. Margaret was a shepherdess. She was a virgin saint, and strangely enough, she was the patron of pregnant women also. Now, shepherdess.
Strangely enough. Another coincidence. Go figure.
Sorry, we've got a pregnant figure looking over into a burial ground, but the female statue is a pregnant figure and allied to a shepherdess. Explains the shepherdess no temptation. She's no sexual temptation, given that she's pregnant. And then we move into two great painters that Poussin and Teniers hold the key piece. One of the great imagery of the Rennes Le Chateau mystery, which obviously comes over to Lincoln courtesy of my work, is the Shepherds of Arcadia, painted by Poussin, and it mentions Teniers. Now, Teniers, I discovered, painted an amazing, a massive, really, really huge painting called The Cabinet of Archduke Leopold in 1637. It's got about 50 smaller paintings within it, actually.
Yes, it's mind-blowing. It is
mind-blowing. But the most central one is happens to be St. Margaret, which is, again, where my work terminates. And hanging over the top right frame of this painting within paintings is a green drape. So it's clearly drawing some sort of attention to itself. And, of course, the place name of where the St. Margaret burial grounds is actually simply The Green.
Yes.
So that was quite interesting, too.
It could almost be like a deck of cards laid out, that drawing with all of those little paintings within it. And then to have that there's a little drapery that Dan is talking about that hangs over the corner of the photograph. It's almost as if you were playing with the deck of cards, and then for some reason someone took a black pen or a green pen and put an X in the corner. I mean, it's that conspicuous.
That's right. There's no other explanation as for why you should have done that at all. It just stands out. It's so obvious that it's an anomaly, as are many of things in the cathedral. The 681 number that's mentioned in the coded cipher, we discover that when we go to the sundial at Lincoln Cathedral, and for some strange reason, it's a sundial, but no hours are recorded before the number 6. And the 681 is explained when we take a look at the equal distance between the number 6, 8, and 1 in 10, actually. That explains that one. It moves us on to by the horse and cross of God, which we discover within the cathedral, hidden away in underneath a seat.
Yes.
In the choir stalls. It's a very strange carving that the cathedral have got no real explanation for. You wouldn't know it was there. Unless you just wouldn't know it was there. They call it the Falling Knight, and it's a picture of a knight on a horse. It looks like he's falling from the horse, and the clumsy arrangement of the horse's legs provide us with the sign of multiplication. It's clearly a cross, and that's our horse and cross of God. And it gets even more interesting when we take a look at studs that are carved on the horse. You've got 4 on one side of it and 7 on the other, and of course you've got the sign of multiplication in the middle. So you multiply the 7 by the 4, and that gives us the number 28, which crops up about 3 times in this mystery, and every time it reinforces itself and actually leads us to X marks the spot. Now, that's well beyond coincidence.
I just wanted to jump in, too, is when you see this sculpture, it's not a little tiny sculpture. It's a significant and beautifully articulated sculpture, but it just happens to be a very peculiar underneath this the chair, like Dan's talking. I just want to make sure people understand that this isn't something the size of, you know, a postage stamp. This is the size.
It's hidden. It's hidden, Mark. You wouldn't know it was there. And you know, as with so many of these strategic items, the cathedral have got no real explanation. If you say, well, what's your take on it? Can you explain what we're looking at here? They're at a loss, really.
It's large. Really... How large is that sculpture? I mean, can you give us an idea?
Oh, well, the one we're talking about, the horse and cross of God, it's under a little seat which you lift up, so that in itself, it's not a huge one. It's rather small, and the details on it again would bypass a cursory glance. Really, you've got to look at this long and deep, and then you see an alternative picture.
Was it like 2 feet long, a foot and a half long, something like that?
Yeah, I'm just trying to gauge it now. Let me have a look. It'll be about 2, maybe a foot by foot by maybe 10 inches or something. Yep.
And it's something that's so artistic that, I mean, under any under a normal circumstance, you would display that because it was a very elaborate sculpture with lots of details such as the ones that you're describing.
And all these things go back chronologically. They all synchronize to the same time scale as well. They're all done at the same time, which is quite interesting as well. If you were going to maintain a secret and leave clues lying around, it's quite conceivable that you would do it all at the same time, really. So that's interesting for me. In the cipher, when we refer to the Demon Guardian, that's our demonic statue that's in the cathedral. And the cathedral have always, you know, when people have said, why on earth have you got a demon statue in a cathedral? It's not what you'd expect to find in there. Again, they just try to brush it to one side and say, oh, it's obviously just some mason's joke, really. Perhaps he was just bored one day and decided to carve a demon statue out of boredom. Not a very convincing explanation, is it?
No, especially in a prominent location, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely. It's crucial. Again, it's not in a random place, and it's got... It's got its left leg crossed over its right, how it's sitting, and on the leg that we can clearly see, it's got a V notch, which even Dan Brown pointed out in his Da Vinci Code is the sign for the chalice, which is one and the same as the grail. So again, it sounds more than just a mason who got bored and decided to carve something meaningless. I don't think so. And it's referred to as an imp from fairy folklore. It's actually referred to as an imp. That's in our English language. And the word comes from Old English, impa, which consequently means shoot, it means offspring, it means graft. Now, in Masonic architecture, a graft is the place of junction of stock and scion, that's spelled S-C-I-O-N. Now, we have to remember the prior of scion in this mystery somewhere. It's exactly the same sounding word. And this S-C-I-O-N, scion, comes from the old French S-I-O-N, which is exactly how we see it in the prior of scion. And that in itself means a young member of a family, a descendant, or an offshoot. Now, is this a reference to what Dan Brown and his Da Vinci Code referred to as the alleged father-child of Jesus and Mary and the prior of Sion who kept the secret? I think very probably so.
Wow. You know what interests me is why did they pick that spot to build the cathedral, and who actually approved building that cathedral?
Well, the answers to that are probably lost in the mists of time. But I mean, to speak in more contemporary terms, a lot of people now accept sacred geometry and how religious buildings are built on PowerPoints, ley lines, and again, it's no coincidence how and where they're built. They always seem to be built on these PowerPoints of energy. And again, the geometry of all these churches do link up. And in my mystery, they also do, too, as well, because we've got an old Templars preceptory 12 miles away called Temple Brewer, which is part of the mystery, and it's in my movie. And I've got some friends, because I'm not exactly skilled in mathematics and geometry as well as I might like to be. I've got people who've done independent research on all the strategic churches in Lincolnshire, in the area that I'm discussing, and there is a geometry where it does revolve around Temple Brewer. So again, it's no coincidence that Lincoln Cathedral was built where it was. And maybe this is why some people say, if it's on an energy point, maybe it's a negative energy point, and this is where the dark, often sinister reputation of it historically may have emanated from, really. It could be a dark, negative energy. But surely if it's entwined in keeping a secret, which would perhaps be better given to the public in the way that we seek truth, maybe that's why it has a dark reputation. I'd also like to just, whilst we're on about sacred geometry, the final part of the code that I read out, at midday blue apples. Now, if you said that to somebody, it could mean anything, but how it decodes at Lincoln Cathedral is certainly related to sacred geometry, because on the 22nd of July, which is the Feast of Mary Magdalene, at 12 o'clock exactly, the sun shines through a strategic pane glass at the southeast corner of the cathedral, or all the actions down the southeast corner, and it creates on the stone floor inside a dappling effect. First of all, you'll get a red blotch, which looks very like a red apple, and then it will be joined by a blue blotch, and they start intermingling and moving about. And this is actually the blue apples that we're witnessing. We see the red apples, and then we see the blue apples appear. Now, that's precisely at 12 o'clock on the 22nd of July. How could that possibly be unless there was sacred geometry employed in the building of the cathedral?
Yeah, we talk about coincidences, but the truth is that there is nothing random happening here either. The people who... the religious figures who were responsible for building this church had to have been in on the messages.
Well, it's either that, Mark, or it's what we refer to as the collective unconscious, which is, when I was talking about synchronicity, and you said it's pretty much a spiritual thing, it's almost messages from Godhead.
Yes.
Again, if I refer you back to that four-fifth of the brain that we all have but don't seem to use, it can well be that a sculptor or a painter might do a specific artwork or sculpture and place it somewhere without really understanding the reason why he's putting it exactly where he's putting it. And that's a directive coming from his unconscious mind So either way, whether it's secret societies who deliberately have maintained the secret and know what they have to do, sometimes I think it's a bit of that, and sometimes I think it's the collective unconscious at work. But either way, things are put exactly where they needed to put. And in the case of the Renly Chateau mystery, which I've transposed over to Lincoln, they've always been there. They've just sat there waiting for somebody to come along like myself. But of course, it is myself who noticed them and then pieced them all together for everybody else to follow. All I've ever done is share my work. I've not kept anything away from the public like some people tend to do. There's not any bits that I really aren't happy to share with everybody. I've been only too happy to piece it all together. It's been quite an arduous task. Sometimes I wanted to give it up. Sometimes I feel as if I've been pushed through the hoop and being driven, actually. But now that I've done it all, it was a sigh of relief to, like, present it in book form and now this movie form and say to everybody, here we are. What are we to make of this?
Well, one thing, I'm going to probably sigh it on the side that I don't know. I mean, while I absolutely believe that people can maybe, the idea that there can be a group consciousness,
yes.
I believe that people can think and believe something into existence. But my initial blush, and again, you're the man who put this together, but my initial interpretation of what you've done is that there are so many precise decisions that had to be made in order for these these events, these clues, to be laid out in such precise ways that I got the feeling that the person or the group of people involved in the making of this cathedral were very, very specific. Okay, here we need to leave this sign. Here we need to leave this sign. And the thing, too, is while you've uncovered so many things, there were probably messages that may have been lost where someone coming to the church would be given other information to help them find and understand what they're looking at. So it just seems like you've kind of uncovered a whole science of communication that falls into like a secret society's way of communicating.
Long ago, Mark, the alchemist Fulcanelli, he kind of discovered that Gothic cathedrals seem to contain codes. He called it the Green Code, actually. And lots of people are willing to accept that the Knights Templars had a hand in the construction of Gothic cathedrals, actually. So if they were preserving the secret, who better than to assist in building these Gothic cathedrals? They certainly have imagery in it that aren't particularly associated with Christianity, but there they are. I think possibly lots of cathedrals have clues in it, like Dan Brown showed of Chartres Cathedral in France. You talk about Rosslyn Chapel. I think lots of them have got things in there to assist us along, but Lincoln Cathedral's got more than its fair share for sure.
I immediately noticed it because I'm an artist, illustrator, designer. I immediately noticed in the landscape of the area around Lincolnshire Cathedral that many of the roofs of the other buildings are red. There's a lot of red brick, red roofs. It's like surrounding it. I wonder if that isn't a symbol of something.
That's quite interesting. I can't say I've noticed that, Barbara. That's quite interesting because Mary Magdalene is often referred to as a scarlet saint, you know,
yes.
Associated with the colour red simply because what we're discussing here, the holy blood, the holy grail, we're not going to be too far away from the colour red for blood, and also the association with scarlet women, the unfortunate title that the church decided to put on Mary Magdalene.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture right now of the cathedral, and it's totally surrounded by red brick, red roofs. I mean, it's just really obvious.
Well, whilst we're on that subject, and I do point out in the documentary, because when I talk about the murder of Mary Magdalene, a dagger comes into the picture. Now, if you view Lincoln Cathedral from the air, you'll see that it's in the shape of the Cross of Lorraine, which is a Knights Templar emblem. It was the first emblem associated with the Knights Templars. And it's also known as, that symbol is also known as the double dagger and also the double cross. So there again, you know, why should the cathedral have been built in such a shape, which is an emblem of the Knights Templar?
That makes so much. You know, one thing, Dan, can you explain to people? We talked about briefly that the Queen Eleanor is staring into the statue of her is staring at a symbol. My impression is that Eleanor was part of this holy was part of the bloodline that led to her daughter in the graveyard. Is that how you perceive that?
Yeah, the statue you're discussing translates in our decipherment as the shepherdess, which is a key figure in all the Renless Chateau mystery. And as I say, it leads over to St. Margaret's burial ground, and Margaret was a shepherdess. Now, where my actual X marks the spot is, it's obviously at a depth under the ground, but there was a church there dedicated to St. Margaret. But it was demolished in 1781. Now, if we nip back over to France for a moment, there was a lady called Marie de Negre, who, if one follows the Renless Chateau mystery, researchers clearly agree that she was perhaps one of the last figures who did know this secret. And she died in the very same year, 1781. So what it looks like is that when this lady died over in France, and the secret went with her, the reality of it, that it terminated under a church in Lincoln, in these burial grounds, the church was demolished the very same year as well.
By the way, we are looking at Barbara found it.
I pulled up an image of the cathedral from an aerial view of it.
Yes.
And I also have a picture of the Knights Templar, and it's a perfect match.
Now that's beyond coincidence, absolutely beyond coincidence. To have actually gone to the lengths to do that, because now we have the technology where it can view things from the air, but centuries ago people couldn't do that.
You see, that's not a group consciousness decision.
That's amazing.
That's the architects who built it, yes.
The smartest men of their time, with a great secret to hold, sent a message to future generations. That's what they were doing. They were that wise and that.
Wow.
And then I can take it a step further, because I did all the research I could possibly do. Absolutely looked under every stone, everything. And then I thought, what's left for me to do? I thought, right, let's turn towards the heavens. So I employed the assistants. Like I said earlier, I'm not a great skilled at mathematics or geometry. If I need any information, I'll find people who can do that for me. And I contacted a chap called Greg Wigby, who's discovered geometry and cathedrals across France. He's well skilled in maths and astronomy with his computers and everything. And I approached Greg. And I said, could you possibly come and orientate and align Lincoln Cathedral for me? So he came over a few years ago with all his equipment and kindly did that. Now, what this meant we could do was we could compare coordinates on the ground with star maps in the heavens to see if there was any correlation between Lincoln Cathedral and any heavenly body up there. And the results couldn't have been better for me, because Greg came away, he did all his work with his computers and his star maps and everything. So again, this is precise science. What he's done is precise science, maths and astronomy or sciences. And he came back with the information that there was a correlation where Lincoln Cathedral, and this is getting back to what Barbara was on about before, why should it be built where it's built, that there is a relationship on the ground with Lincoln Cathedral, and in the heavens with the star Arcturus, which is from the constellation Bootes. Now, Arcturus, the star, is actually the home of the Arthurian legends, which, of course, is the Holy Grail. Now, you see, I couldn't make that up, Mark. I couldn't make that up.
Went to that extent?
Well, this is how accurate it is.
Oh, my God.
And then to take it a step further, Arcturus is referred to in astronomy as the guardian of the bear, and that bear is the...
Oh.
were to Ren Le Chateau on the ground is related to the constellation of the Great Bear. So it confirms to me that Lincoln Cathedral is the guardian of the Great Bear, and in doing so is the guardian of the secret of Ren Le Chateau.
Well, I'm getting like the hairs on my neck standing up. I'm still kind of dealing with the Arthurian legend and the idea that that would be tied.
Well, the name Arthur, of King Arthur, actually comes from Arcturus. That's where it originates from, apparently.
That's a very, very fascinating piece of information. You know, one of the there's a couple things I want to talk. I want to talk about your walk in the tunnels. But I also,
right.
There's this one painting that it was done by the Pre-Raphaelites, a Pre-Raphaelite painter, where he depicts a woman whose head has been covered, and she's pointing. This is a symbolism rich painting that seems to illustrate much of what you're discussing, what we're discussing tonight.
Well, that's right. I discovered it. It's actually in the Antwerp Museum in Belgium at the moment. It's a very mysterious painting that was referred to as Invocation by a chap who named himself Eugène Samain, which is an adopted name. And I went through that step by step, and again it revealed the number 28 yet again. And if you orientate the painting, if you were to look at the painting and stand at the southeast corner of the cathedral, you'll see that we're perfectly orientated, and again it's just leading a short distance across to the burial grounds and our marker tomb again. Now this happens two or three times. One of the most amazing confirmations for me is if we go back in the cathedral, in 1800, a chap who used to be in the Royal Academy of Art, Matthew William Peters, he quit the art world and he joined the church. Now, his paintings, he was famous for painting salacious women. That's what I've been told. That's not my phraseology, but that's what he was famous for, painting salacious women. And you have to remember that poor old Mary Magdalene was always given this totally unfair appellation of being a harlot. We know that's not true, but this is what the church put on her. So anyway, this Matthew William Peters quit the art world. He was famous for paintings of salacious women. Now, he went on to become the canon of Lincoln Cathedral. And what he did was, when he became the canon, he painted striking, and it's quite a large one too, painting, which he called the Annunciation. Now, it was supposed to be a painting of the Virgin Mary, but when we look at it, we can clearly see it's not the Virgin Mary, it is of Mary Magdalene. Now, I showed this to Margaret Starbird, who is an amazing researcher into images of the Sacred Feminine, and she agrees with me that what we're looking at is not the Virgin Mary. It's clearly Mary Magdalene. She has the red hair. She's dressed in red. These are the colours that are associated with Mary. She's pregnant in the painting. But lo and behold, she's looking over a short distance at a black monolith, which appears to have scrolls or parchments on the top of them. And it's exactly our marker tomb, which we again end our quest in the Margaret's burial ground. She's looking over at it. So we have a painting supposed to be the Virgin Mary. Again, when you know what you're looking for, you will see the true picture. It's of Mary Magdalene, and she's looking at the monolith, which is the marker tomb over in our burial grounds.
Another interesting, you talk about Victor Hugo, and you,
yes.
Part of the Priory of Sion?
Yes, he was one of the more recent alleged members, as was Da Vinci, and was Isaac Newton too. Now, what happens was that I'd made the connection between Ren Le Chateau and Lincoln Cathedral. I'd gone in there and spotted all the anomalies. I'd decoded the parchments. And if that wasn't enough, I discovered through serendipity, which is, again, very like synchronicity. It's amazing how I was led to it. But I discovered a dossier in a library in Grantham, which isn't too far away. It's about maybe 30 miles away from Lincoln Cathedral. Now, because... the library have this dossier. It's very precious to them, but nobody in living memory can tell you exactly when it was deposited there or who by. It's dated 1918, which is the same year that Berenger Saunier died in France at Rennes-le-Château. Now, it's simply called Wyville, and it's a search for a place called Wyville. Now, it's handwritten, it's over 30 pages long, and it's allegedly written by Victor Hugo. Now, the first thing I did was compare the handwriting. It doesn't look like Victor Hugo's handwriting to me, but that doesn't really affect anything other than why is somebody trying to pass this off as a Victor Hugo dossier, because he was France's most famous novelist at the time the Rennes-le-Château mystery was originally starting over in France. Now, the documents in the Grantham Library, which is housed in the Isaac Newton Shopping Centre, and there's a fantastic statue of Isaac Newton outside looking at the library. So you've got two alleged members of the Priory of Sion. You've got Victor Hugo and Isaac Newton tied up here in this dossier. Now, the search for Wyville is quite incongruous to start off with, because Wyville is an actual place. It's a very small village. So we have this document where we start at Wyville to go and search for Wyville, which really doesn't make a lot of sense. But when you follow the intimations in this dossier, lo and behold, it leads you back to the very place where my Lincoln Cathedral code ends. Exactly.
Wow.
And the thing is, because it's a search for Wyville starting at Wyville and doesn't make sense, I've since discovered, I'm pretty convinced, that the reason why this is so is that even if it's Wyville, spelled W-Y-V-I-L-L-E, it's not sending you off on a search to find the Wyville that you're departing from. It's actually a Masonic play on word, and this is what the Templars and the Masons did do with phonetic puns and play on words. It's actually Wife Hill, which is referring to Mary Magdalene, the alleged wife of Jesus Christ. So Wyville becomes Wife Hill. Now that does make sense, particularly when it concludes exactly where my other research also concluded.
And you've got two different connections to the Priory of Sion, whose task, it's speculated, was to make sure that the secret of the real chalice was found, or was to end up.
That's correct. The mythologies of the Holy Grail going back in the 12th century was always a very veiled symbolic means of ensuring that people were forever keeping the message in the secret alive and well, and intimating that there was something of great importance to be found. In those days, like we mentioned earlier, people thought it, perceived it as just a chalice, but it's a lot more important than that, because it was dealing with Jesus, Mary, marriage, a child, and an alleged bloodline. But my research, and this is where it differs with all other thoughts on the Rennes-le-Château mystery, is that there's not actually a bloodline out there resulting from a childbirth from Mary via her husband Jesus. That was actually terminated, and that is the real secret of Rennes-le-Château. It's as disturbing as it sounds, a pregnant Mary was murdered carrying child. Now, when I discovered the Wyville dossier, there's illustrations with it also, and the very first illustration is that of a dagger. So then my consciousness was drawn to, now where does a dagger fit in here? Bearing in mind what I told you earlier, that Lincoln Cathedral from the air, the Cross of Lorraine, is actually known as a double dagger, and also known as the double cross. Mm-hmm. Now, I went back to Da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper, again, earlier I mentioned that it was a long, long time before people realized that in the painting, alongside the Mary Magdalene figure, if we can accept that is Mary, and lots of us now do, there is a disembodied hand wielding a knife. So again, I thought, there seems to be a connection beckoning here. Now, it got even more interesting when, in 2002, a private Swiss collection, a private art collection, announced to the public that it had a never-seen-before Da Vinci painting, and we got to see it in 2006. Now, it's a painting of Mary Magdalene, so Da Vinci did do a painting of Mary Magdalene. Now, when we take a look at it, with that consciousness I discussed, that don't just settle for seeing what you expect to see, she's holding a veil, and if we look at just above the veil, you can actually see what appears to be scar tissue down her left abdomen, and also that the garb that she's actually holding is crumpled, and you can see it represents a dagger shape. So in that one painting alone, we've got reference to a dagger, and we've got scar tissue above Mary's left abdomen. So that set me off thinking, are there other paintings or representations of Mary Magdalene that might show a similar incision point that obviously we would not have noticed before, because we wouldn't have been looking for it? And I have found some, and in the DVD I presented one of the most striking ones, which was a sculpture from a Spanish lady. I don't actually talk about it in an interview, because if people want to see that, I think they're going to have to see the movie. But it's very, very convincing, because in it we see an indication of a dagger and an incision point, and it's always in the same place, the left abdomen. Every time it's in the same place. Now, the enduring mythology of a pregnant Magdalene giving birth to a child and promoting a bloodline. The legends say that the child was born and it was called Sarah, but my suspicions are that this is just a veiled reference to the word viscera, which is again referring to the lower abdomen, where I believe Mary was incised and lost her life.
Well, let's see, where can I go with this? I mean, there's so many. You're bringing up quite a few things. You did show there's the headless female figure that you refer to as the.
Well, that's
body.
Amazing. That's amazing, because, like you said before, this painting that I referred to, which is in Antwerp Museum, it has a guardian sitting there, and it's got a coffin with a headless female in there. But when Hollywood came, here we go again, an amazing synchronicity or coincidence, if people prefer to see it that way. But when Hollywood came to film the Da Vinci Code at Lincoln Cathedral, workmen had to dig the ground to lay some cable down to provide extra lighting for it. And at the southeast corner of the west transept, they discovered a coffin. Sarcophagus there that nobody had any idea was there at all. Now, the cathedral archaeologists were quickly in there. They confirmed that they dated back to 14th or 15th century, that it was the remains of a woman, and the skull was missing, and there was no lid on the coffin, exactly the same as in this painting that now hangs in the Antwerp Museum, exactly the same. Now, it's just, again, not acceptable, but in a place as prestigious as the grounds of Lincoln Cathedral, where there's centuries ago, and even today, if you were to arrange for a family member to be placed there, it would require an awful amount of legislation, paperwork, and records would be kept. But here we are, they found a tomb of a decapitated lady, and they've no idea who she is or what it's even doing there. Now, I believe that this was deliberately placed as a red herring centuries ago, perhaps done secretly, obviously, because there's no records of it, so that if anybody had got any indication that there was a tomb of Mary Magdalene in the area, they would perhaps have stumbled across this, found it rather uneventful, and given up any further search. Whereas the actual X marks the spot that I'm announcing is no distance away at all. It's just about a minute's walk away from there. The interesting thing is, though, that that the lady was discovered decapitated, because the burial grounds that we're talking about, St. Margaret ended her life decapitated. But I see that one as a red herring to put people off. But wasn't it absolutely amazing that when they were filming the Da Vinci Code, they just happened accidentally to discover it?
Wow. So you don't think, I mean, would she have been beheaded because of some crime against the church? I mean, there's probably an endless number of reasons why people would have been beheaded at that time.
It's quite a historical thing. I think it was a punishment meted out centuries ago, really. I think they believed that by doing so, your soul didn't ascend to heaven or something like that. It's also interesting, though, that the Knights Templars, when they were set up and disbanded and all these ridiculous claims were made against them, which we now know were never true, but it was the only way to disband them, they were supposed to worship the cat, and they were also supposed to worship the head. And I often wonder that when we look at the word cathedral, we see cat and we see head in the word cathedral. So maybe what the cat and head they were worshipping was Lincoln Cathedral. It's a possibility.
That's interesting. Well, I doubt it was the Dr. Seuss book, The Cat and the Hat. I just had to throw that out there. But
yeah.
Now, I wanted to bring up, in the movie you showed on the outside of the cathedral, there was a sculpture of Mary holding the baby, supposedly.
Right, yes, that's very visual, Barbara. We're told that, obviously people can't see it as I'm discussing this, but I'll try my best. We have allegedly Jesus Christ above a female holding a child. Now, we're told that what we're seeing is Jesus Christ above Mary, the Virgin Mary, holding the baby Jesus. Now, it doesn't make sense that you've got Jesus above his mother holding him. It doesn't make sense. I think what we're actually seeing is Jesus Christ looking down, and it's Mary Magdalene and child. It makes a lot more sense than that. And when you take a close look at the Jesus figure above the Mary and child, he's wearing a robe, and it's got a very strange knot tying this sash.
Yes.
It's a very, very particular knot. And I believe that that's Freemasonry telling us that he'd tied the knot, which is a phrase that goes back to Roman days and means to be married. And why is that statue of Mary, if it's supposed to be the Virgin Mary, and Lincoln Cathedral's dedicated to the Virgin Mary, if that's supposed to be the Virgin Mary, why is she outside the church? Because where we see this is called the Judgment Porch. And this is exactly what the church did do, the past judgment of Mary Magdalene, and edited it out of the Gospels. And that's why I think we're seeing this statue put outside the cathedral in the same way that Mary Magdalene was excluded too.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't it unusual if it was Mary, the mother of Christ, to have her on the outside?
Yeah,
it's not.
It should be outside. She's cast out, exactly how Mary Magdalene was cast out of the Gospels.
Exactly.
That and the positioning as you're describing it, it's as if Jesus were the top of a family tree, and then his descendants would be positioned below.
That makes sense.
It truly does. And so when you see it, it's so we're so often saying, "Oh, that's Jesus, that's Mary, the Virgin Mother." It's like, okay, that's all I'm supposed to think about. That's all I'm going to think about. But if you're someone who knows or has a different belief system, and you see that, it's very easy to draw the conclusion that must be Jesus' child represented down there.
This is what I mean, Mark, about having that ability now to see what was actually there to be seen, rather than just accepting what we're told to see, which is what the brain prefers to do initially. It takes the easy way out and it sees what it's told to see. But when it's when you can bypass that in the same way that you can bypass the brain with optical illusions, then you just see an entire different picture unfold before you.
Well, another thing too, of course, Dan, is let's say you're a person of that time, and you're looking, and you're being told that's Jesus, and you're being told by an authority figure that you don't dare question.
Exactly.
At the risk of your life, frankly.
Well, that's how it used to be, yes. That's how it used to be. It's also interesting, Mark, that that Lincoln, in fact, was home to one of the most important Jewish communities in England, you know, as early as 1154. So we've even got a very strong Jewish connection in the same area.
Well, does this lead us to talking about the different tunnels that connect so many critical places in and around the cathedral? Can you talk a little bit about what you think these maps, what do you think these tunnels lead to, and a little bit about the journey that you took? Because I don't think that was officially sanctioned, frankly.
No, historically in the British Isles, you know, we've got a wealth of cathedrals and castles. Now, historically, they always had tunnels for the purpose of, like, escape exits, just in case, you know, we had the Crusades over here and a lot of these buildings were sacked and things were taken from them. But historically, when they were constructed, there was always kind of tunnels so that if ever they needed to get out in a hurry, they could do that and get away at a safe distance. So historically, the British Isles, castles and cathedrals, not all of them, but some, and it's a fact, you know, some are open to the public, can be riddled with tunnels. Now, Lincoln Castle is only 2 minutes walk away from the cathedral. It's ever so close. So, again, it would make sense that you had a tunnel connecting the two. Now, Lincoln's always had a mythology of tunnels. I remember speaking to people's grandparents when they were young children, and they would say, oh, yes, we know there's tunnels. Some have been sealed up. We've heard about local authority going and sealing them up because they're not safe and stuff like that. A correspondent got in touch with me, and she said that when she was a young child, she came on a school trip to Lincoln Cathedral in the 1950s, and they were shown where tunnels were meant to exist, but they were also told at that time that they were going to be sealed because they were considered not poo safe. The Bishop's Palace, which is just adjacent to the cathedral and is very historical as well, they surprised me because when I was refused my scan, I was ever surprised that the bishop's castle confirmed to me that they'd always, living memory allows, that there was always a rumour of a tunnel being there as well, which would lead to the vicinity that's crucial to my work. So I'd done a bit of research, and it meant that I came in contact with some people who had pretty first-hand information about the existence of these tunnels. So when I put it all together, I sketched out a map of tunnels that anecdotes people had told me were certainly there. Some people had even accessed them during their own childhood and such. So it gave me a good indication of where I needed to be if I was to access a tunnel. Now, again, it was just a chance encounter. My son one day, he'd made friends with somebody at university, and when they were walking at the southeast corner of the cathedral, this young man who knew nothing of my work, actually, he said, oh, you know, we're standing above a tunnel. And my son's ears picked up and said, well, what do you mean? And he said, oh, my mother used to work at the Bishop's Palace long ago, and she told me there's a tunnel there that connects to an underground church. So that was amazing how that information just landed in my lap, and it also confirmed what the Bishop's Palace had said, that they'd always were aware that it was a secret tunnel somewhere in their area. But the thing about secret tunnels is precisely that. The reason why you can't find them is because they are secret. And archaeologists, they like to dismiss them and say, well, no, we've heard rumours and myths about these things, but there's no reality to it. And they base that on the fact that they can't find them. Well, this is precisely why they are secret tunnels, because you can't find them. They are so secretive. And then another amazing story came my way from a property, no real distance from the cathedral, and this took us back to the 1960s. It was like a care home, what we call a care home, for girls who had got themselves into problems and were awaiting having to go to court. It's what we in this country refer to as like a naughty girl's home. And to cut the long story short, I spoke to a woman who had been there at the time in the 60s, and she said, once upon a time, the girls had been a bit naughty. Now, they put her down in a cellar, really, which I'm not saying they should have done, but because of her behaviours, they put her down in a cellar. And much later, when they went to retrieve her, they found that she'd gone missing. So when they went down in the cellar, she'd gone along a tunnel which was down there, and the staff had to go and obviously fetch her back, and it led all the way to the cathedral. So all these stories were coming my way about tunnels in the area, which would be fortunate for me, obviously, if I was not allowed a scan. The only other way would be to perhaps physically try and get in under the ground. And that's about as much as I can say, really, Mark, because when you see the movie, as you have done, you'll see that I have access to a specific tunnel, but it wouldn't be too clever of me to say exactly how I accessed that tunnel, because the possibility would be that it would then be sealed or some similar thing. I was very fortunate to be in there, Well, but that's as much as I dare say about it.
Well, if I could say, you did spend a great deal of time down there, and you traveled a long distance.
Oh, some of the tunnels were ridiculous, because obviously I had a film crew with me. Now,
yes.
Obviously, when you see the movie trailer, sometimes the film crew's in front of me. Now, that there were areas that were easily accessible at the time, and obviously to do a trailer, you need to do to show something like that exactly what you can. But the reality of it is that the film crew could not follow me along some of the more narrow tunnels, because they were quite small indeed, very small indeed. Some people would question the wisdom of me accessing them, really. It was very uncomfortable. The conditions certainly wouldn't be very hygienic.
No.
But the film crew couldn't film me along the very most important tunnels, because they just couldn't do it with their equipment, or they certainly didn't have the physical structure to manage to do that. So after a long time down there, with many twists and turns, and I managed to get along a specific tunnel which, to my information, should have put me exactly in the area I needed to be. And when I accessed it, a very difficult one to access, at the crucial point, it just terminated and it was sealed.
Well, that must have been very disappointing, but did you find any other signs, information, details when you were in the tunnel? Were there any other things that emerged? I mean, that maybe you would not have known. What did you discover? Was there something unique that you discovered from being inside the tunnels?
Well, for me, like I say, with the information that came my way, I managed to draw a bit of a scale map, and the tunnel I actually accessed seemed to be leading me exactly where I would expect to be, bringing me to the conclusion of my quest, the area where the demolished church once stood. I have to admit, there was nothing down there, nothing in the way of clues or anything like that. It was just a very unpleasant place to be, very dark, and I wouldn't know how long it had been before anybody had been down there, really. But there was nothing, no marks or anything like that. It was just simply a very tight passage which led exactly in the direction that I believe I needed to be in. And like you say, it was sealed. It was sealed. So if there was a further access into an underground crypt, which is where my work concludes, I certainly wasn't going to access it through there. When and how it had been sealed, I've got no idea.
Well, one of the things that, going back, we talked about this earlier, was the X marks the spot.
Yes.
And that the church refused you access to going and screening the ground. Was the tunnel somewhere where this crypt might have been?
Absolutely. From my orientation, I think we were absolutely in that vicinity. It was related to the information at the Bishop's Palace had said that they did concede that there'd been a long enduring story that had never gone away, that they were hosts somewhere in their property to tunnel that led in that area. So I was never a great distance away from where I needed to be that much, I'm pretty certain, pretty confident.
Well, we've discussed the idea that Mary Magdalene had been killed. We're not saying who by who, although I think the speculation would be the church authorities at the time, which would have probably made them Catholic.
Yeah, well, yes, like I say, my research is still ongoing, Mark, actually. The many times that I thought, well, that's it, I can't possibly come up with anything else, well, I'm afraid stuff still did find its way to me, so my research is still ongoing regards that. But yes, a lot of people would think that, again, going back to the Leonardo da Vinci Last Supper painting, the figure right next to Mary Magdalene is Peter, and he's making a very unpleasant gesture, a slicing gesture across her throat level, and it's quite conceivable that he may be the figure that's associated with the disembodied blade. So a lot of people, I think Dan Brown fans picked up on this as well, but clearly Peter, who went on to form the Catholic Church, was not a very great fan of Mary Magdalene.
Well, if you look back in time, there were a number of sects, a number of groups that identified themselves as Jesus, and they were competing for followers. And so
yes.
People would probably go to great lengths. Let's say in that time frame, you felt that God was telling you that you were the one, the right one to carry on Jesus' message. And then to have someone who would be perceived as a competitor, it might be very worthwhile or very justifiable to eliminate them.
Well, that's right. I mean, a lot of other researchers, because the earliest aspects of my work has been touched on by many other before, by some very good researchers. Like I say, where my work differs is that I've had to announce that it seems to me like Mary Magdalene was demised and did not give birth to a child, and that there is no bloodline. But Mary was clearly taken out of the Gospels. The information is that she was Jesus' favored apostle, and that she was expected to carry on the message of Christianity in his absence. Now, a lot of us now realize that the early church was at least very misogynistic. It had no time for, shall we say, equal rights for females, and clearly would not have liked a female figure challenging the authority of what was to become a very paternal church. And when we look throughout history, unfortunately, prominent females have always been removed from the scene, going back to like Joan of Arc, even Marilyn Monroe, and our Lady Diana, and more recently Benazir Bhutto, you know, very prominent iconoclastic females who may challenge the male authority of the day, always seem to be removed from the picture, sadly. So why should it have been any different for Mary Magdalene, who may well have been expected to have carried on Jesus' message rather than an organized body of church?
Well, they killed off the Cathars, and we actually, it's interesting. 2 weeks ago, we had someone on who wrote a book about the connection. He wrote a book of fiction, but it was historic fiction based on very good research on the Cathars and Knights Templar. Glenn Craney, and he's his book touched on some of the similar things. Although he was writing excellent fiction. You're dealing with a place where the facts lie in front of you. So that's a pretty fascinating detail. We had talked to, I mean, I didn't mean to blow by this topic. There was a large, successful Jewish community in the area. Did they have any connection to this at all?
Well, it's not there now, actually, Mark. It was a historical thing because there was a purge against the Jews in the British Isles in the year 1290. But prior to that, the community in Lincoln was the second most established outside of the capital city of London. So we had at the same time, we had the Knights Templars not so far away, at Temple Bar, thriving, and we had a Jewish community in Lincoln. So everything that's needed, all the ingredients that are needed in this equation are exactly where they should be and all at the same time. But no, That's a historical episode that we're discussing there. They were kind of chased out of Lincoln.
Well, one question I have is that this bloodline must have continued. I mean, if you consider the birth of Christ took place, what, in 33? I mean, Christ died in 33 B.C., maybe his first offspring, A.D., I'm sorry, the year 33, and now we're talking about 1200, so it stands to reason that perhaps Jesus' bloodline carried on for 1,000 years plus.
This is what a lot of people seem to favor. I think when it's now fairly well accepted by a lot of people who reject the Orthodox storyline, which was force-fed us by the Church. If we see Jesus Mary as an item and that they did have a child, that would have almost certainly have been the starting point for a bloodline. But unfortunately, in my scenario, I don't think that actually happened. I think it would have happened, should have happened, but it was terminated. And that is the real secret that nobody really wants coming out. What's more controversial, that there was a bloodline or that there was and then it was terminated? Either way, it's both very disturbing and controversial towards the Orthodox storyline that the Church are failing to maintain now, because a lot of people are rejecting it. We live in a day and age where it's a lot easier to do your own research now. We have the technology of the internet. I mean, many years ago, before the internet, if you wanted to do research, you'd have to go to the local library. You could spend hours just looking for a book, or you could order a book that could take months. But now you've got instant information at your fingertips, and more people, now that it's safe to do so, are doing their own personal research and seeing how the original storyline is struggling to maintain itself, really. The fact that Jesus, a rabbi, in that day and age, it would have been unthinkable that a 30-year-old Jewish teacher was unmarried. The expectations were that you had to be married. It just doesn't really stand up.
You would have been an unusual, considered an unusual rabbi at the
time. Absolutely, yes. The expectations were that, you know, they were all married. That's what you did. It was the most natural thing, and that's what you did. But obviously, the Church say, well, Jesus was a divinity and therefore wouldn't succumb to temptations of the flesh. And to marry him off and sire children is to, in their eyes, erode at his divinity, really.
Well, one thing, I just want to get my head around a time frame. So are you saying that all of this happened at a later time, the birth of Christ, than we first think? Or was the Church, was Jesus born, we always say, you know, our modern times began with the time birth of Christ, and then we move forward. So if that were the case, then if his direct offspring were to come to England, it would have happened in the first century, I guess. So how do you see the timing on all of this?
I stick with like you said, the Jesus figure aspired to the age of 33. So you're looking at 33 A.D. A marriage to a Mary Magdalene figure. And I suspect that Mary, I do accept that she fled to France. This is why we have the instigation of the earliest Rennes Le Chateau myths and legends that she was over in France. But I think she was pursued by her captors and demised pretty shortly afterwards, really.
And then the people of southern France, or they held on to the body and moved it to England?
Yes, because where she allegedly fled to, again, was a very strong Jewish community, so they'd have welcomed her and looked after her, but she was clearly pursued. And I think that at some point she may well have had a resting place in a tomb at Rennes Le Chateau, but she's since been moved. This is why people still look for Mary in France. But my research, which I say is ongoing, I think, yes, she did go to Rennes Le Chateau when she tried to escape the captors. But no, she didn't live out her life there, and she didn't sire a child. I think she was demised. and may have been put in a tomb in France. But when people were seeking this tomb, obviously, there'd be evidence of the true storyline and relics and such that, again, when people were pursuing this and getting too close to discovering it, it would again have to be moved. And okay. It's found its way to England.
And that's where all of the... So it wasn't that she lived in England, but she, 1,000 years after her death, these things may have been... I'm being very, very loose with the figures. I just want to make sure so I understand that they're moving the relics, the treasure, the body of Christ, although... Mary. So yeah. These are the things that they're moving. And they built the church around these relics. And so they knew what they were doing when they built the church because they had the treasure in their hands already.
I think that's quite possibly the case. The only other scenario is that obviously if Mary and her relics were on the move, she'd have to be taken somewhere. And the fact that she's arrived in Lincoln, England, it can well be timescale-wise that a lot of the clues were put in place after it was known where she was residing.
Because
a lot of the clues regarding Lincoln Cathedral, we're looking at like 13th century. So I think it's more probable that when she arrived in Lincoln and that was consolidated and that was the renewed secret, then the clues were placed around about there.
So that she, her body, her remains, that was the treasure.
That's what is often referred to as the treasure of Rennes-le-Château. But in order to confirm what the bones would be, you would have to have documentation with it, parchment scrolls and documentation to tell the true story. And this is a theme that Dan Brown picked up on as well, actually. He said, whereas Mary was the Holy Grail, equally important was the documents that followed her around to confirm the authenticity of who and what she had been.
Wow. Well, I have to tell you, we've really enjoyed... I could talk about this for quite a while still tonight, but I wanted to make sure that people knew where they could find the film and where if they wanted to contact you with questions or if they wanted to come take a tour. Dan, where could they find you in England? And how could, and where, I mean, if they wanted to set up a tour, how would they reach you?
The best way to do that, Mark, would simply be to go to Reality Films, and the quickest way of doing that is to go on YouTube, type in Murder of Mary Magdalene, you'll see the film trailer, and then you'll see a link that will take you to Reality Films who are distributing it, and they could contact me via that agency.
Okay. And the film is for sale. It's available here in the United States.
But yeah, very much is, yes. On any if you just type the title in, actually DVD as well, on any server, you'll see all the DVD outlets on the net will have it available.
Well, we have people that listen all around the world. We're very fortunate. We feel we're very thankful for our listeners in the UK, in Australia. I guess, Barbara, do we have anybody in New Zealand? I know we've got them throughout. They're throughout Europe, China. We have quite a few people. I think Finland. We tend to have listeners from Finland, and so I'd like to think that there are people around the world that are hearing about your film.
And Dan, I had one last question. Who's in charge of the cathedral today?
Well, it's not a Catholic institution. It's an Anglican church. And like I said earlier on, Barbara, they're an authority to themselves, really. So it's the chief executive is usually the chap that's approached at Lincoln Cathedral.
Well, are they open to giving tours? Do they give tours? I imagine it's still very much a working cathedral.
Oh yes, it's open. I think the 7 days of the week. There's obviously times, but yes, it's a wonderful structure. In amongst all the cathedrals in the British Isles, it is one of the most amazing structures. Actually, I have no argument with the actual architecture of Lincoln Cathedral. It's a splendid place to visit.
If and just to help me, I don't know where Lincolnshire is In England?
Oh, don't worry about that. right, we've okay. A simple lesson in the orientation. We've got a north and a south. Okay, in England, we've got a north and a south in England, and also in the British Isles, of course. Now, Lincoln Cathedral is in what we call the Midlands, which is short for the Middlelands, because we're right in the middle. We're not north. We're not south. We're in the middle, and Lincoln Cathedral is the East Midlands. In the city of Lincoln.
Well, thank you for the geography. I know a little bit about England, but I have, and we plan to come and visit, but and we'll get better at the geography. So please forgive my silly question. I want to ask you to try to find where our little town is. So.
Well, I originally lived further north in England. Again, it's part of the strangeness associated with all this, but circumstances arranged themselves, Mark. On three occasions, I came from where I lived further in the country. Three times I was brought to Lincoln. Now, the first two times, I just stayed a short while and headed back up north. But the third time, I actually came and stayed, and that was in 1998. And then 7 years later, I found myself caught up in discovering the Lincoln Cathedral Code and everything else that's had to follow.
Well, that's... Dan, let's one last thing. You said that you have ongoing research. If you've got some details that you'd like to come back, we wouldn't. If you want to come back for our, just a part of the show to say, hey, I've got a new scoop. There's something that I think our listeners would love to hear about. Please contact me because I'm sure we've had a good number of listeners tonight, and I'd be very glad to give you a chance to talk about it and. Again, to talk about the work that you're doing, because it's fascinating, and I think it can open people's minds up. And I don't mean it doesn't take anything away faith in God. It just I think it adds to it.
You're quite right, Mark. That's all I wanted to do, really. I mean, for a lot of people, they're quite happy with their beliefs, and that's fine. If it works for them, that's fine. I'm not here to upset or erode anybody's beliefs, but for those who just don't feel that we're being given the full 360 degrees, or they're not quite sure that the truth has been explained entirely, my work's there as the other side of the coin for them to look at. All I'm doing is seeking the truth, really.
Well... Dan, you've been a real trooper to stay up so late with us. We really do appreciate this, and I really appreciate it. It's a fascinating story, and it's a beautifully done film, and I highly recommend that our listeners check it out. Reality Films, and go to YouTube, and you'll find it. And Dan, I guess we should probably let you get to sleep. Gosh, only knows.
Yes, I have to be up again at 7 o'clock. No, actually, I've got a busy day ahead.
Well, on behalf of all of the people who've been listening tonight, thank you so much for sharing. Try to get a little sleep.
I will. Thank you very much. It's been cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Good night.
Take care, both of you. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, I have to tell you that I really enjoyed that. Barbara, wasn't that fun?
What a trooper. He's up at 7 in the from 3... Or 3 to 6 or whatever.
Yeah,
oh my God!
3 to 5. So he's gonna get a whopping 2 hours of sleep or so, something like that, prior to going to work or the rest of his busy day. And I found it fascinating. Barb.
Well, that's definitely another place we have to visit when we're in England.
So far, I think we're gonna be just going to the north, the south, and the Midlands. That's about all I think we're
gonna
be doing. And Wales, you know, we're gonna get up to and Scotland. So I think it's going to probably require we spend a little time over there, but I do appreciate this. If anyone wants to call and they have a quick question for me psychically, please give me a call, 818-574-8412, 818-574-8412. I'm available. I can take if someone calls quick. I'm very glad to help. I wanted to let people know that that Queen Con is coming up. April 30th, May 1st, I'll be appearing on that Saturday night to do a psychometry demonstration. There are quite a few great people. If you want to learn more about it, look up Dawn Shy, and she'll be able to give Dawn Shy a Google. And I think if you look up Queen Con, you'll see that there's some great videos. You go to her Facebook. Great work, great videos. It'll give you a wonderful idea about the scope of the talent and the personalities that will be appearing at the Queen Mary. And Don will have coming up more information about what to expect during this exciting event. I also know that Don has put her heart and soul into doing this, and I encourage as many people as possible, if you can be in the Los Angeles area, April 30th, May 1st, that you'll have a wonderful time. The Queen Mary never disappoints. I'm sure you've heard that from many people. It's true for me and Barbara, and we've had a lot of fun with it. There's no doubt going to be some interesting spirits on board, but as much as anything, Don has assembled a wonderful group of speakers, from the Booth brothers to Richard Sennett, Patrick Burns.
We'll be doing a ghost investigation with Patrick Burns and Marley Gibson. We're going to go probably back to the engine room where we had quite a few experiences. And hopefully we'll get to go to the cargo hold, which is in the bottom of the ship. That'll be interesting.
They may have closed that off.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
What happened?
New people who have leased, who now run the Queen Mary, are now saying that the cargo hold may be off limits.
Why?
So this is something I just heard about today.
Ooh.
And so I would suggest that if you haven't been to the cargo hold, it may be a while before you get a chance to go down there and investigate. It was a fascinating place. It still is. Don will be able to explain more about that. But still, even if that part of the ship is not available, there's so much more to see and do that makes it an exciting and worthwhile trip and a wonderful destination. And certainly Don has put together a special event. Barbara and I are going to be taking off next Thursday. In honor of Tax Day, we're going to go take the night off, and we're going to cry a little bit. Just a little bit. It
wasn't that bad.
She's right. It wasn't that bad. Barbara made sure it wasn't that bad. But we will be doing an encore show, and then we'll bring one of our favorites back for everyone to listen to. And then the following week, we're going to have an author that we've had on before. She's going to be she and some investigators. This is like the first kind of a wilderness paranormal investigation that I'm aware of. It took place in Wellington, Washington. It's a town that no longer exists, and it was the site of a huge avalanche that killed about 100 people all at once. It's now supposed to be an incredibly haunted place. We're going to have Karen Fraser, author of Avalanche of Souls, and please forgive me, I can't remember the name of the organization. We've got some other great people who went with her that actually brought her there for the investigation. So it's a great book. It's a unique location in that it's very remote and difficult to get to. And the investigators did a great job in finding some startling information and great. They brought home real interesting results. EVPs that are hard to argue with. I mean, they're there, and other exciting information. And Karen will be able to tell you more about it very soon. And also, too, I'm going to send out a little apology to Henry and Beth. We were supposed to do a show with them, and we got mixed up in terms of East Coast versus West Coast time. So if you're listening, we look forward to having you, making it up to you and to being on the show with you. So, Barbara, was there anything else you wanted to say?
No, just wrapping up another great show. I love Dan. He was a wonderful guest, and we look forward to more wonderful guests coming up.
Yep. Well, I think you'll enjoy Karen. I had to tell you, too, I don't know how effective a speaker and presenter I would be, or an interview for that matter, at 3 to 5 in the morning. I would probably be drooling and mumbling to myself and nodding off. Barbara would probably have to throw hot coffee on me, not just let me drink it. So, again, kudos to Dan for being up and staying with us. Fascinating information, and I look forward to some of his updates. Well, so have a wonderful tax day. Oh, my gosh, that's a total oxymoron. Please, all of you, I hope you survive April 15th. I know you will without us, but we will have an encore show. So you will be back live on April 22nd. Until then, Barbara, thank you so much for running things as she does so well.
All right. And everyone out there, have a wonderful evening and a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Have a positively psychic week, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
This has been a Para-X production, sponsored by CBS Radio. We'll see you next week on Positively Psychic. This is Barbara Nelson from Positively Psychic with your host, psychic medium Mark Christopher Nelson on Para-X Radio. Mark and I would like to thank all of our listeners for their support of our web radio show, Positively Psychic. With your support, we can keep bringing you the best web radio programming and Podomatic and iTunes downloading. So keep listening, and we'll keep bringing you great paranormal programs from Positively Psychic, with guests like John Searle, Patrick Burns, Marla Gibson, Allison Dubois, and Chris Fleming. So tune in each week, every Thursday evening, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 Eastern on Para-X Radio, the leader in paranormal web radio. Thanks again for your support, and we'll see you here next time on Positively Psychic. Each Thursday evening, 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific, join us each Thursday evening with fascinating guests and call-in readings. We'll see you next time on Positively Psychic.
Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.